Okay, good morning, members. The tax committee will come to order, and we're going to start with Representative Leaders, Bill. And we are not, we don't quite have a quorum, so we're not going to move it yet, Representative Leader, but let's get started with your House File 4017. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, House File 417 deals with the Housing Authority, the Northwest Minnesota Housing Authority. Under present statute, they have levy authority, but a portion of the levy authority that they have is optional, and what they are requesting this is to be authorized to levy that additional portion of the levy that they have, which is not optional, and actually it would authorize the counties all to participate. And I have Mr. Wally could explain it. I'm going to give him an opportunity to explain it because I probably do a better job than he would.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Kevin Wally, and speaking on behalf of the Northwest Minnesota Multi-County HRA, Representative Leader's Bill does provide the authority to the HRA to approve up to 25% of their levy. The 75% would continue to be approved by the individual counties, their pro rata share of the levy. The HRA operated for over 30 years without imposing a levy with operating funds received from state and federal housing programs. They've instituted a levy now for the last 4 years in order to provide some local resources for homeowner assistance and for rental assistance within the region in order to serve affordable housing needs. What they're trying to do with this provision is to ensure that at least 25% of their base levy is available at the discretion of their board. Their board is made up of members who are all appointed by the county boards, and their practice has been to go to each county board to justify their levy each year. Now, as a special taxing district, they could go and vote on their own, but they have respected the relationship that they have with the county boards and want to proceed in this way to specifically authorize 25% of the levy with the local board's discretion, and then continue as they have with the county boards in building the case for the remainder of the levy. So this would institutionalize that practice in that part of the state.
Okay, questions from members for Representative Leader or Mr. Wally? Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wally, is this being done elsewhere in the state, or is this are we setting a precedent here, or what are we doing?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Simpson, there are two multi-county HRAs in the state of Minnesota, just two. There's the Northwest Minnesota Multi-County HRA, and there's the Southeast Minnesota Multi-County HRA, which is in Representative Wolfswager's area. There was a bit of controversy on this issue last year in the Southeast region, and the two HRAs, multi-county HRAs, were actually part of that bill last year. And so what has transpired in the intervening months is that this proposal has come forward for just the Northwest HRA. If there's precedent to be had here, it's precedent that would have to be followed by the Southeast Multi-County HRA in a subsequent bill in a subsequent session. And my understanding is that this time the Southeast Minnesota Multi-County HRA is not proposing to go forward in deference to the issues that were surfaced last year with respect to that part of the state. So it is limited, direct answer to your question, it is limited to these two circumstances, but we're only tackling the one.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And this is an extension that's been playing out, so it's a five-year extension. Will this five-year time frame be the last time we come back in, or will we see this again, or what's the future look like for this?
Mr. Wally. Madam Chair, Representative Simpson, my expectation would be that going beyond the five-year span would be based on the ongoing good relationship between the HRA's operations and the relationship they have with the counties.
Thank you.
Question, Markford?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I guess my question for Mr. Wally is, on these special taxing districts like hospital districts, around the state, do the county boards all have to approve of those, or is there any independence? Or, I mean, why isn't, how's it set up overall around the state?
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Markhart, generally special taxing districts have authority in their own right. If you're a regional development commission, for example, the Board of Regional Development Commission certifies the levy. What has transpired here in this instance is that the HRA board is made up of only of appointees from the particular county board. And when they began with this process of having instituting levy, they went through an entire process of educating the board and justifying their levy requests to the board, and did not exercise any authority in their own right absent the oversight and approval of those county boards. That's been the practice. They've not wanted to depart from that practice dramatically. They've conferred with the counties. They have concurrence to institute this mechanism whereby 25% of their levy would be at the discretion of the HRA board, and the remainder of the levy would continue as it has, actually going through the county boards for their approval, even though special taxing districts would have the authority to exercise more discretion, more approval in their own right than this body has.
And, oh, Representative Marquardt,
I know, like watershed districts, they levy, you know, on their own, but it has to ultimately go through the county board. They have to place their stamp of approval, and that's why I'm just, and you look at your property tax statement, you have those special districts, and, you know, I know, not watershed districts, I'm thinking lake improvement districts, not watershed districts, those are separate, but lake improvement districts have to go through counties and that, so I'm just, I'm a little confused on this, Madam Chair.
And there is public, there are others from the public who want to testify. Representative Wolfwater.
Chair members, Mr. Wally, my district was in this last year, and what I learned kind of the hard way is that there were some personality differences, and I'm just talking about Southeast Minnesota. And so for some people, it looked like hard feelings and an end run around the process. And so as a result of that, I pulled out. And I just, to follow up a year later, I mean, do you have some of the same issues in Northwestern, or was that unique to Southeastern Minnesota not getting along?
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Wolfhager, it's a fair question. The Northwest HRA, I think, has done a real good job of communicating with the counties specifically what they're asking for, and none of them have voiced opposition after having a specific briefing. In fact, three of them wrote letters of support for the provision, three of the six, and none of the other three voiced any opposition. So in direct answer to your question, there's not been that kind of friction in that relationship.
Mr. Wally, and I know there was there more reps in the fire. You know, I think if I'm understanding your bill correctly, your group here, your Minnesota multi-county HRA Northwest, wants to tax part of the area really without their approval, in the sense that the individual cities or counties aren't going to, for 25%, won't actually get to vote on that if this legislation were to pass. Is that accurate, Mr. Wally?
Madam Chair, just to sort of clarify the scope of the levy, there are two cities that have their own HRAs within this region, and they are not, their properties are not taxed. They have their own levy authority. I think it's Crookston and East Grand Forks are the two local HRAs that have their own levy authority. 25% of the levy for those six counties would be voted on at the discretion of this six-member board who are appointed by the counties. And so they're still answerable to those county boards and indeed would be authorized to exercise this levy authority by virtue of their appointment by those county boards. But as I said, they've actually not exercised that authority in their own right. Because of the desire to have that relationship and understanding between the counties and the HRA. So there's still representation.
And Mr. Wally, I think, you know, there's a nuance difference being made here, and I understand that. I think this committee in general gets nervous about non-elected folks being able to levy. And that certainly happens in other places in the tax code. You know, the Met Council is a classic example, and there's a lot of feelings about that, mm-hmm. Around this table, and how people feel about expanding the authority of those who are not elected to levy a tax, understanding they do have the accountability to these elected officials who are putting them on those boards. But I think Representative Marquardt has raised the issue that, you know, in general, these HRAs then have to have their budgets approved by their city council or their county board. And so if I'm understanding this correctly, 25% of the levy would actually not need to take that step. Yes, these people are selected by elected officials, but they are not running for election themselves, and therefore the voters can't toss them out if they don't appreciate the work they're doing. Is that accurate? I mean, I don't want to misrepresent the bill here, Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, yes, I think you've captured it.
Okay, is there anyone from the public who would like to testify on this bill? Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I guess I have to express concern about this bill. I think, finally, the membership of the committee has captured what is being proposed here. The Northwest Minnesota Multi-County HRA, nor any other HRA, does not have independent taxing authority at this time. Cities, counties exercise levy authority on behalf of those entities, and consequently the city council members or county boards in this particular instance are ultimately answerable to their constituents for the tax decisions that are made on behalf of the entity. This legislation wouldn't be here right now unless the board wanted to exercise that authority independently of their individual members. Obviously, as a representative of counties, we've taken our fair share of criticism over our levy decisions over the past years, but to some extent, those levies are outside of our control because, as the chair mentioned, they are being made by unelected entities. The board membership is made up by appointees from the individual county board, but if any one county did not want to go forward with this, the majority of the board could override them on that decision. Consequently, that's my reason for raising concern about this board. If you're truly concerned about the blossoming increases in property taxes, don't create a separate authority for another entity to levy property taxes. Keep it within the scope right now. There's nothing preventing for this levy occurring other than possible decisions made by the individual counties that they do not want to go forward with that. With that, I'll conclude my testimony. Be happy to answer any questions.
Representative,
I don't know who this is. Maybe to Representative Leader or Mr. Wally. Is this a joint powers board right now?
Mr. Wally or Representative Leader, is this a joint powers board now?
My understanding is it is not. It's organized as a housing redevelopment authority under Minnesota statutes. I have it right here.
Well, Mike,
Representative
Sullivan. Usually when you have joint powers such as this, you have some kind of a joint powers board that's in some kind of resolution for the county to be able to participate in it, and then if that is a resolution, it's usually the county has the right to withdraw from it as well, and that's my question.
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, the housing redevelopment authorities are under sections 469.001 through 469.047. And they are designated as special taxing districts under Minnesota Statute 275.066. Now, that is the provision under which these entities establish or certify their levies. We're not proposing to do an end run around the counties here. In fact, the irony here is that the counties have been supportive of this approach to try to allow the HRA to to levy up to 25% of its levy so that it has some operational certainty with respect to its state budget. In terms of their ability to exit, I have to confess, I don't know the provisions under the HRA authority that specifically provide for a one government entity that's part of a multi-governmental HRA to withdraw. I happen to have the statutes with me, but I don't know that particular provision, but I would imagine that there is the opportunity for individual counties to make their departure.
Just some clarification maybe later on.
Okay.
I don't want to spend my time on it.
Are there others who want to testify for or against this bill? Representative Earhart has a question. Representative Leader, I want you to know something. I was just trying to ask, you know, kind of through the row here, Mr. Michael. I have an HRA levy bill as well, and Ms. Carlson Wallach just told me I have not introduced it yet, so I asked Mr. Michael via Ms. Carlson Wallach, you know, where that bill was, and he said it's lost somewhere. So anyway, we are going to hear a bill yet this year that actually nonetheless, it actually expands the levy authority for all HRAs in the entire state. It doesn't change their powers. They're currently would be following the same rules that they have to go through their cities and counties, but it gives them a higher percentage rate of levy capability, which I think would help kind of everybody's problems, including the problem being presented by Mr. Wally. And I think people have not known I'm going to do that, so they haven't been able to take a look at that bill. So I would, you know, ask you to take a look at that bill. I think the problem people are having is the one that Representative Wolfwager has highlighted too, and Representative Marquardt. And I think we just need to think about, if some folks in your multi-county want to do this, why don't the folks who don't want to do it pull out and let all the people who want to stay in do it jointly and let the people who are not interested pull out. But I think we just need to keep thinking about them, and I just wanted you to know, Representative Leader, that there's another bill that's going to come forward that may achieve your objectives without kind of having to do this part that people are having some discomfort with. So think about that. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you explained this before, I forget it, but who is the... Who makes up the Housing and Redevelopment Authority? How are the people? Is it one person from each county, or they're all appointed, or, you know, what's the mix?
Mr. Wally. Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, yes. The board is made up of a representative from each of the six participating counties, and the county board appoints that person. In fact, in one instance, it is a county commissioner, but in five instances, it's a local business person.
Okay.
It's an attorney, an accountant.
So, people, by and large, who are not elected.
In five of the six instances, they were not elected officials.
They were given them taxing authority.
Representative Earhart, you've picked up what others have. Yes, you came late, and that's what we're all kind of queuing off of. And Representative Earhart, you know, I think the correct issue here is, and that is the case in lots of HRAs, I'm sure, in your city and mine, you have both electeds and non on there, but in the end, the city council of Edina has to approve the levy, or the county. And so that's what's different here, and I think that's what many of us are having concerns with. So we'll just keep working on that. Any other questions? Anyone else from the public? Well, Representative Leader, we appreciate you bringing this forward, and I hope you'll continue to work with the tax committee on how we might solve this issue, a problem for you, and yet not expand taxing authority to folks who aren't running for office, or at least have a choice for their elected officials. So we'll keep working on it.
Madam Chair, I have an idea.
Perhaps I'm later.
There could be a chief change in the chief author of 4017, that would take care of it.
Thank you for that. With that, we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the honor of the tax bill. Thank you, Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam.
Oh, and you know, did we ever move it? I'm sorry. I'm going to move the bill because we never did. We didn't have a quorum, and now I'm going to lay the bill over. So thank you, Representative Leader. Let's see. We've got House File 2763. Representative Gardner, welcome to the committee. And let's see. Representative Tilbury, is Representative Tilbury here? Who's in Anoka County? Would someone like to move this Anoka County? If not, I will move House File 2763. Welcome, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we'll make you an honorary citizen of Anoka County for that. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, House File 2763 amends a special existing law for Anoka County Libraries that deals with bonding. In this special law, there are two limits on the amount of debt service the county may assume. One is the lesser of 0.01% of the taxable market value, or a dollar limitation of $1,250,000. This bill was initiated in 1984, and inflation has really taken hold, which has made the dollar limitation particularly difficult to deal with when addressing the need to expand or build a new library. And so that's why we're here today. Specifically, this will allow the upgrading the library in Circle Pines to build a new regional library in eastern Anoka County in Lionel Lakes, and both of those are in my district. I would keep it short here and just mention that on an average home, average median or median home price of $216,000, which is roughly the median in my district, the annual increase in cost for debt service on this would then be $1.82 a year. I'd have some closing comments, but first I will turn it over to Marlene Moulton Jansen, the Director of Anoka County Libraries.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Marlene Moulton Jansen, and I'm the Director of the Libraries for Anoka County. As a result of the special legislation, Anoka County was able to achieve efficiency through a centralized system and provision of branches that serve a large area. Anoka County's small cities could not have borne the hefty cost of the needed libraries. We now serve a population of 327,000 residents with 6 branch libraries and 2 area libraries. There's only one small branch library on the east side of county. It is in Circle Pines, just a few miles north of the Ramsey County line. The number of residents and their needs have far outgrown the capacity for this facility. Our new area library farther north will be able to serve our residents on the eastern side of the county, where the population is rapidly expanding. The cost of land and construction is also rapidly increasing. The dollar amount in the original law, once sufficient, now is no longer workable, as it is not kept up with inflation. Removing the dollar amount while retaining the cap, the percentage cap, will allow Anoka County to address this area's needs in a more timely fashion. Therefore, I ask for the committee's support. Thank you, Madam Chair. I am willing to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Other questions for Representative Gardner or his testifier, Representative Brock?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gardner, I'm just trying to understand what in the law today does not allow the county to bond for the library. I'm just trying to get a sense of the structure around the original special legislation, maybe the need for the cap.
Moulton Jansen, did you want to answer? And Representative Brown, I was just looking at the same thing. On House File 2763, it appears Anoka County has a special law already. And I'm just trying to, we're trying to figure out what do all the other counties do. I think Representative Broad's going to ask the same question. Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, imagine my surprise at coming to the legislature to realize there is, in fact, a statute specific to Anoka County on libraries. I'm not quite sure of the origin of that, but I think one or two other metro counties do have levy limits set in state statutes, but other metro counties do not. And I understand that two counties actually have, Washington, Ramsey, and Dakota County have a under general levy limit of 2% of market value of the in the county, and this is actually at 0.01% of total market value. I don't know if Ms. Shriver from Anoka County knows the exact origin of how it came about, but if you really want to know, I suppose you could come up, but I know you quite like to keep
it. Representative Gardner and Representative Broad, Mr. Michael's indicating that there's some large counties that already have special authority. Representative Gardner is trying to amend it here, but I think, you know, maybe a a look at kind of all, what do all the counties do and what do the medium-sized counties do? I mean, definitely the folks who are not residents of the large counties in the state are beneficiaries of the fact that Anoka is solving its problem locally as opposed to in state resources. So everybody else gets the benefit that Anoka is willing to raise taxes to do this, but I guess we've never really seen kind of the whole gamut. Representative Rod.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess my question is more related to what in state law does not allow them to do this through general obligation bonds already?
Mr. Michael.
Well, yeah, or the general property tax levy. Nothing.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, the county would have a couple of other options for financing this library under other laws. For example, they could, under Chapter 475, issue bonds subject to a referendum. Generally, you know, you don't try to avoid that when possible. The other option would be to use county capital improvement bonding authority. That's subject to a cap, and counties tend to view that as a scarce resource that they would prefer to not use if possible. And so this special law, which allows them to issue these bonds without a referendum, is attractive to them, I'm sure, and they just want to raise the limit some. Now, Chapter 154, the first tax bill that was passed, significantly increased the limit under the county capital improvement bonding authority, and so I'm not sure if they're aware of that, but that sort of makes that a more viable option. Those bonds are subject to a reverse referendum. But in part, all of these debt options tend to be driven in part by the desire to avoid submitting these things to the voters.
Representative Broad.
That's fine, Madam Chair.
Okay. Did you track all that, Representative Gardner?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yeah, what Mr. Michael is referencing is the bill we passed already this year had a public finance provision that expanded counties' authority to do some levies. So, did you want to testify? Yes. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Lona Shriver. I'm the Intergovernmental Coordinator for Anoka County. The special law that was passed for Anoka, that Anoka County requested back in 1984, was because they wanted to get into the library business in a bigger way than most counties do. Many counties have no county libraries at all. They let the cities build their libraries, and then they provide the operating and maintenance money that they're required to levy for that purpose. We have, in Anoka County, we still do very small communities, 21 small communities, and on their own, they really couldn't provide a good library service. So it was decided that we do more of a county-wide library system. And so they did seek, at that time, the special levying authority. So this new library bumps the limit, a new library being proposed bumps the limit that was put in, and our finance people were aware of the new law that was passed, but I think they wish to use this special law as their authority to pack the bonds for the library, the new library.
Okay, so Ms. Driver, I think we all are now thinking about all this. You know, this committee, Hennepin County has a big library, a massive library levy, which was not done on referendum. And Minneapolis did actually take their library funding to the voters, and the voters of Minneapolis passed it and are paying a higher property taxes for libraries. Then the wrinkle came in with the Twin Stadium, where somehow the Twin Stadium was paying for the library. It's all quite odd. And so now we've got Anoka. And then we've got the expansion and the ability to bond for counties that we just passed on, I think, March 7th of this year. So I think I'm glad Representative Gardner's brought this forward. I think we all just need to keep thinking about how these pieces come together. We have Representative Coles and then Solberg. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gardner, I trust you understand that the bill that you're proposing would impose almost $2 million of additional property taxes on the taxpayers of Anoka County.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, I was noticing you seem to show up in committee just when my bills come up. I did see the House Research blurb and thought you would actually ask that very question.
Representative Gardner, he missed your comment on the per capita price.
No, yes,
given
I was here and I heard it.
Okay.
Madam Chair, whether it's $1.98
yes,
a household or not,
yes,
it's a $2 million property tax increase on the
yes,
taxpayers of Anoka County.
That's
nearly
right.
That.
No, and yes. Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, Representative Fulber, yes.
Okay, so Representative Fulber.
Comments of representatives years ago had those targets
Madam Chair, Representative Fulber, I've had one on here since I got
Representative Fulber.
But my question is a serious one.
Yes.
And that is the changing of 0.1% to 1.5% increase. Oh, I'm sorry, am I reading that wrong?
Yeah.
Do we still keep the 0.1 cents, whichever is smaller?
Correct.
Yes. Yeah.
Pay for us through that. Okay.
Then I
read it wrong.
You know, I do think members just have to think, step aside from Anoka's library or the previous bill. Everyone has to think about, since this is a committee that does the local public financing, not the state bonding, we do all the local bonding. You know, much of the bonding authority that exists for all kinds of organizations, whether it's libraries or counties or HRAs or watersheds or the Met Council or whatever, which is all the purview of this committee, has not been changed in a long time. And those pieces of legislation that were constructed as a dollar cap probably aren't working too well as opposed to percentages. So, you know, I'm not a big advocate for trying to help property taxes go up, but I understand that these things that were set, you know, 20 and 30 and 40 years ago, and that's one of the reasons I have an HRA levy bill, because there really has not been infusions for HRAs for years. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you. Just off of Representative Cole's question. Representative Gardner, you just introduced a property tax bill. How much would that cut property taxes?
Representative Gardner.
Oh, gosh. Madam Chair and Representative Marquardt, the House File 4188 would increase the maximum refund allowable under the property tax refund program and circuit breakers, so that would actually, for seniors and people on fixed incomes in Anoka County and Ramsey County, I don't know the exact number, but it would be dozens of times greater than the $1.82 increase per household.
Representative Cole, at that point, I think Representative Marquardt is just, you know, throwing him a softball, okay? And you get that, Representative Cole.
Question for you, Madam Chair. Do we anticipate Representative Gardner's bill being in one of
maybe
many
omnibus
tax bills coming out of this committee?
Representative Cole, now you're throwing me a softball. We absolutely hope to convince all of you, and I've been working with Representative Marquardt, and he's getting ready to close up his division report, to absolutely find a way to provide property tax relief yet this year, and we certainly hope to do along the lines of what we were proposing last year, is to base the property tax more on the ability to pay and make it a more progressive system. So Representative Gardner's bill is of great interest, and there are many bills like his and others, a lot of ideas, and yes, we do want Representative Coles to join us in voting for significant property tax relief yet this year. So thank you for asking that, Representative Coles. And Representative Gardner, we like to give each other a hard time in this committee, so that's just the culture.
I'm cool with that, Madam Chair.
Is there further public testimony on this bill? Other questions? If not, thank you, Representative Gardner. We're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Very good. Madam Chair, I just was going to make one closing comment for the record, because the old library and the new library are both in my district, and this bill has actually helped create a working group in Circle Pines and Lexington so that they can talk about the transition from the old library to the new library. The old one is rather small and cramped, but it's a well-loved community asset, and this bill process has actually allowed all those parties to come together. So Anoka County is talking about how to ease that transition and make sure they can use that site for some public community purpose.
Okay.
I just wanted that on the record, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that. Appreciate it. With that, members, we're going to hear from Representative Mahoney. And does Representative Lesh want to move this bill? And Representative Lesh, Representative Mahoney has an amendment as well. Do you have, I think it's Representative Lesh. Maybe I shouldn't speak. I'm not sure that Representative Lesh This isn't a St. Paulville, actually, is it?
No, ma'am, no. It's not. It's the Minnesota.
Okay.
Bill.
Well, yes, I think. Okay, the tax credit group here, which is kind of Representative Paulson and Coles and Dabney and Mullery, they're happy. So Representative Coles moves House File 3315.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could get the attention of the committee, it'd be nice if we could find one other group member from the tax credit group to move the A1 amendment to get it into the form that I would like it to be.
Representative Coles, would you like to make the motion for the A1 amendment?
Anything to help my friend, Representative Coles.
Representative Coles moves the A1 amendment. Representative Coles moves the A1 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. If not, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're just trying to build bridges around this place. members, I can explain this bill. I'm told from the conversations that you just had about the tax credit group and such, sounds like there's been a number of them. This bill is on research and development tax credit for approximately $3 million. It is targeted towards small companies. Today's R&D research tax credit is at an approximate $25 million, $24 million. It is eaten up by large companies at the rate of $21 million. There are only 40 companies eat it up, leaving a very small number for the smaller companies. This is a bill that is directed towards even smaller companies with 30 people or less. A few prepared remarks, and then I will have my testifiers speak to the glowing example of what this bill will do and set myself up for questions. Open myself up for questions. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Minnesota's economy has got its problems right now, and we've done an excellent job this session so far setting it up for short-term recovery. But as our chief economist, Dr. Stenson, has said, we need to make strategic investments long-range, long-term. And that's what this bill does. Our research and development is the key to long-range economic growth. They generally pay more money. They create more jobs than almost any other kind of an investment. Minnesota, on an academic level, has sunk from 20th to 40th over a 20-year period. This bill, 3315, provides that 20%. It's really, I'm not sure how many others that you've seen provide a refundable tax credit to businesses, both on a corporate and personal income. This is a major shift in some of our tax policy, and I hope it opens it up to discussion for that. These small entrepreneurs are very mobile in today's world. They can go anywhere, and we'd like to keep them here. We spend a lot of money educating them. We are a brain power state. We really are. And they don't have to stay here, but we'd like to keep them here because of the money that they create for us. Keep in mind, members, that we are not an island. North Dakota has increased its R&D tax credit to 20%. Iowa, 6.5%, which with a refundable credit. Wisconsin is a 5% credit. In California, the big kahuna, as someone would say, has a 24% tax credit on basic research and a 15% on excess of qualified research expenses over. I'm not sure what computer-based period spending means, but I'm sure somebody on this committee does. California found that its credit not only stimulates more research and development for the companies that are located in California, but it also induces firms from outside of California to relocate the research and development there. We've made significant investments in the University of Minnesota and Mayo. We need to profit from them. We have some bills coming through that kind of put benchmarks in front of them to create jobs, to patents and licensing agreements into place. Once they do that, we want them to license and patent to companies in the state of Minnesota. And I believe this particular bill will do that. Madam Chair, I would like to introduce Joseph Shaw from Fintron. He's a chief executive officer of a small company based out of the UEL. And he has a few words for it, and then I'll bring up my other testifier, and we'll all be available for questions.
Welcome, Mr. Shaw.
Thank you very much. I've reviewed the bill, and I've spoken with Representative Mahoney about it. I think it's the beginning in supporting small biotech companies and high-tech technology in the state of Minnesota. I've been privileged to having worked in four different countries in the last 15 years and worked in at least six states starting and developing biotechnology. I was privileged to be on the Prime Minister's Council in Australia for supporting the development of biotechnology in Australia. And I can assure this group that tax credits regarding R&D are an effective way of maintaining and having companies move forward that are starting up. The funding that's saved is often put into the development of other markets outside of the normal markets to increase the number of employees that are within an organization. The state of Minnesota does have some issues regarding funding startup biotech in the lack of mezzanine financing. Having things like tax credits to help us with R&D would be extremely helpful in moving forward. I do have one criticism of the bill. It's not enough. We need more. If the concept is sound at this amount, it should be sound for a greater amount. Biotechnology is a highly intensive economic almost sinkhole for R&D money. They take a lot of money to get a product to the marketplace, and I think this is a very solid and creative beginning. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Appreciate the testimony. And Mr. Rep. Mahoney, you have another testifier? Then we'll take questions.
Yes, I have Bob Hare from Nanocopia. I have a harder time with the name of his company than his name.
Trying to be that way.
Welcome.
And I will let him introduce himself.
Welcome. Welcome, Mr. Hare.
My name is Bob Hare. I'm president and CEO of a development stage company, Nanocopia, which is based here in St. Paul, actually in the old BCA building. So we're taking advantage of retired state infrastructure, and it's been great for us. Our technology is in the nanotechnology area, and we're using University of Minnesota-invented technology to coat medical devices such as coronary stents with drug-eluting materials and also to formulate drugs to improve their performance. It's an exciting area. It's an emerging technology. The reason I'm here today is to share my perspective as somebody who's worked in the biomedical industry in Minnesota since moving here in 1990, working in one other development stage company as well as this company which I founded, and serving 2 years as president of MinBio before it merged into Life Science Alley. Minnesota looks at the medical device industry, for example, as the goose that laid the golden egg, that it's just going to keep on giving. I can tell you that that is changing. Jobs are leaving this state. Startups are not occurring at the same level that they used to occur. When Boston Scientific laid off its 600 or so employees up in Maple Grove, if the state had been primed to do this sort of activity, among many others, which I will be talking to you more about over the next two sessions, you would have had more startup companies formed with those engineers who left that company that otherwise had to relocate. The state of Ohio, where I'm doing some research right now up in the northeast quadrant near the Cleveland Clinic in Akron, recently adopted the Third Frontier Program, which is a $1.5 billion initiative to develop these kinds of technologies, a large portion of that for biomedicine. State of Indiana has the 21st Century Fund, where they're granting between $2 and $5 million in grants, not credits, to companies in this early stage. And we're looking at companies that are pre-revenue, that so-called valley of death, where companies typically fail unless they get access to capital. We are being recruited right now by the state of Ohio to move to Ohio, offering incredible incentives. We would like to succeed in Minnesota. This bill is one of the examples of the kinds of things that you are going to need to do if you want to preserve that goose that's laying the golden egg. The medical device industry is changing. It's moving to devices that are more biomaterial-like. Biotechnology and the medical device industry are merging their technology along with the pharmaceutical industry. We don't have that biotech and drug infrastructure in the state of Minnesota. Therefore, the large companies even are developing that technology in California and other places. Medtronic, for example. So unless we take a long-term view and start with bills like this, and Representative Mahoney heard me give this message when I spoke about our what I think is very exciting technology at the Life Science Valley meeting last fall, and he grabbed me afterwards and he says, "What is happening?" Well, the point is that we've been asleep in Minnesota. Things are happening despite our state's efforts. But I want to get your attention and have you start to listen to what the opportunities are and what could be in Minnesota if we take the kind of view that other states who see similar economies like ours are doing right now in our own backyard. And so with that, I'm going to stop. I think that this is the very least you can do to start to stem the tide. So whether or not you agree with this credit in a specific form or not, don't argue with that. The point is, this needs to be passed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hare. And now questions of either of the testifiers, Representative Mahoney, Representative Dammer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mahoney, thank you. I think this makes common sense. It makes good sense, and I personally agree with this. I'm sorry if that's right. I didn't catch your name.
It's Robert Hare.
Hare. Thank you, Mr. Hare. A question, Mr. Hare. We have, we've been talking in this committee now for most of this session. Of course, we have concerns about the budget and that sort of thing. And, of course, we do expend quite a bit of state dollars, state tax dollars, trying to incent businesses and offer, you know, whether it's Job Z, whether it's R&D credits, whatever. We have some of these types of programs. One of the thoughts that's been thrown out in our committee that we've been working on here is to maybe do away with all of the special credits like that, all of the special incentives, but maybe offset that with lowering the income tax rate by a point. Would you comment on the merits of that from maybe the perspective of your company and maybe other companies like yours on the merits of that as a budget saving? It would save, I think, the bill, if I'm not mistaken, Madam Chair, is about $170 million would save the state of Minnesota by lowering the tax rate by a point, but then doing away with any kind of special assessments or special incentives, let me say.
Are you talking about corporate taxes or individual taxes?
Madam Chair,
corporate tax.
It's okay. Corporate tax.
Let me tell you what that would do for me. Zero. We are pre-revenue. We've been pre-revenue for 4 years. We're just starting to turn the corner. We've had no help from the state of Minnesota other than the fact that we're living in one of your old buildings. The incentives are not there for our angel investors who want and are excited about what we're doing. But you are missing the fertile, fermenting ground where these companies get formed if that's the approach that you're going to take. You're going to have to do a whole lot more to look earlier in the pre-revenue cycle if you want to have an impact and create the jobs for the future. Now, I've created, in our company, we've created, I won't say I, 6 new jobs this year with an average salary of $70,000. That's what you want to see happening. And that's happening because of angel investors. It's not happening because of tax, lowering a tax rate. This will help us in the early stages, the next 2 years, this particular bill. But that lowering of a point will do zero for us.
Thank you.
Representative Wall Snyder, then Representative Dill.
Chair members, Mr. Hare, Mr. Shaw, I live in a small town, and the biggest thing that we see is or are the young people leaving. And so I'm very interested in keeping our young people here in Minnesota. So we had our state economist and our state demographer a couple months ago come to our small town and talk. And one thing that these gentlemen highlighted is that, and he gave a couple states, he said Colorado and Washington State and Oregon are attracting young people more on average than some other states. And, you know, that was a huge red flag, but, I mean, he never mentioned tax credits per se, but can you comment generally about you know, keeping young people in the state, would this do anything for that, or is there something going on in Colorado and Washington and Oregon, you know, besides the weather?
Interesting you brought that up. Sorry.
No problem.
It's interesting you brought that up. Centurion is actually supported, and the technology was developed by a small company called Wilma Poultry in Wilma, Minnesota. And in fact, this technology has created 30 jobs in manufacture of veterinary vaccines in Wilmer. The ability of this bill to provide tax credits would incentivize those organizations such as Wilmer Poultry, which is a very substantive, almost $750 million company, to be part of supporting small entities like Centurion. We are a small company, but they have done a lot of the funding to us through loans and some investments. So there's an answer that I think that these kind of tax credits will incentivize this kind of development in small cities. We're an example of it.
Okay. Representative Honey.
I can only echo what Mr. Shaw has said, but you know, you've seen a number of R&D credits and tax credits coming out of the bioscience committee, carried by members from that particular committee, because we spent a tremendous amount of time on VC and capital development. What the other part to that is that we, in Representative Rukavina's committee, have finally decided to get serious about going after federal monies that can, and the SBIR and the SBTR, which is small business development monies for innovative products. And hopefully that does keep some of our, the people that we spend a lot of money educating in the state here in the state. And the nice thing about biotechnology and some of the bio industries is it doesn't have to be in Minneapolis, St. Paul. It can move out to Alexandria, to Red Wing, to Austin, to wherever, and manufacture with the internet connections today and the transportation bill that we passed. We'll be able to get to and from everywhere fairly well.
Okay, Representative Dillon, Fallberg, Representative
Dillon. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to go back to Representative Dammer's question. And
he's right up there, so he's listening.
And comment on that. I think that the number one thing that was said by Mr. Hare is that the companies that benefit and the state that benefits from this R&D credit is the pre-income companies. And there are so many examples of this. I actually look for a small percentage of what I invest in for pre-income companies because a lot of them fail. My ratio is 10 to 1. 9 fail, 1 makes it. But when 1 makes it, it's usually a home run. And I just sat down and thought about for a few moments about the things that I've invested in Minnesota that have hit home runs. And they are, in my personal life, it's electronic recycling. I mean, some time ago, we didn't even know what electronic recycling was or how to do it. And there was an emerging company, and now is the largest in the Midwest, that's located in St. Paul. That is the kind of a company that would have benefited from that. Obviously, medical devices. Robotics. Huge opportunities in robotics as we get more efficient. Emerging. Drug development, everyone knows about drug development, and another one is genomics. So these are really important things that people that have brain trust in their mind, that they have those ideas, and we help them incentivize during that non-income period when they are reaching out to investors to embrace that opportunity, to bring that forward and be productive in wherever state it's in, but let's hope in Minnesota. So that's the reason that I would be supporting. And I know we debate the subsidies that we give to businesses all the time in here because they do cost money, but that's one of the reasons I support it.
Representative Simpson? Okay. Further questions?
Representative Simpson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Harris, I think you indicated that Ohio is a state that is actively pursuing the activities that your company does and companies like yours. There's a lot of rhetoric that's been held here about how we have a quality of life and we have a good education mm-hmm. system and we have all the key things that people want to live here for. What what is holding you, your company here, when you have a state like Ohio that's pursuing you with these types of credits? Are they going to have the effect that's going to continue drawing these companies out of Minnesota, or do we? This bill is what will keep us here. Just kind of touch on that if you would.
Well, this bill, considered as a single bill, won't achieve that. Mm-hmm. Considered it within the environment of what we're trying to accomplish, will be an important underpinning. I grew up in Indiana, so I'm a transplant. I've been here since 1990, and I haven't left. My kids won't leave. They won't. I have a son who's senior at University of Minnesota. My co-founder is from Grand Rapids. She won't leave. You've got a captive audience because Minnesotans typically want to stay here. But that only goes so far. And when you see the opportunity, for example, we're looking at setting up a subsidiary in Ohio, which would mean that further job growth would occur there so that we can stay here. That's the kind of decision making that goes on, I mean, in the trenches. And that's really what I'm coming on, because that's what I live every day.
May I comment to the question too, Madam?
Yes, Mr. Shaw, please.
I'm not from here. I have 3 passports. And I like Sydney, Australia very much. But the reality of those of us who are entrepreneurs who have put companies together is often the person who invests the money who determines where the company's headquartered. And in the case right now, most of the funding for biotechnology is coming from the coast. If there is an incentive in the state of Minnesota, those investors can be talked into leaving the companies where they are. I obviously have chosen to live here, so I don't want to degrade Minnesota. I like it very much. It's where I choose to live. But often the reality of the funding becomes significant. So if there are incentives, such as the tax break for R&D here, those people who have the funds aren't quite so anxious to have you relocate so they can look at you every day. They're more prepared to let us remain here.
Further questions? Representative Simpson? No. Okay. Representative
Fulbert. Mr. Hare, why would you deny your employees in Ohio the quality of life that you're having here in Minnesota?
You know, that's a really hard question to answer. Ohio's looking better and better. I know you did. The point is that there are a lot of really tremendous resources here. I think the university is just beginning to figure out how to work with business and start companies. We were one of the early examples where instead of us paying a license fee, they took ownership in our company. And so we've been able, as a result of that relationship, to get SBIR funding of almost $1.5 million now. Those are sorts of things that enable us to stay here and take advantage of the quality of life and the beauty.
Manager, on a serious note, one of the, I think Mr. Harris said that other states have a cash incentive instead of a tax credit. And you also mentioned now you've got some influx of funds from SBA or other things. Sometimes I think in a small business setting up, it's the cash flow, the ability to have some cash up front that will allow you to attract other businesses. R&D credit is maybe important, but it's also after the fact. And I guess my question is, what would be the most profitable for small business startups? Would it be better to have, I don't want to say a 20% refund that was mentioned, because when we established that for the mineral industry, that's all of a sudden disappeared, and we're fighting to get it back. But would a cash program be better?
Mr. Hare, I'm sure you'll say yes.
Well,
you like the cash?
What I'm going to say is that I think we need to take a comprehensive look at what our state strengths are and where we should have targeted investment to build on that strength. And that's not something that's going to come out of this session or even necessarily the next session, but it's something that, you know, I'm working with Life Science Alley, BioBusiness Alliance, MinNano, and we're going to be coming forward with very serious proposals to engage you, help you to interact with what's happening in other states and see exactly what's happening. And lets you see with some solid data what the kind of investment that we think is required will come back in the form of jobs and growth and retention of companies and people. So I'm here today because I see this as a foothold. It's a very important foothold. I've asked for money twice now from the legislature. Last year we asked for it for the nanotechnology initiative. It got squeezed out in conference committee. This year it didn't get included from the House. It was a request for $250,000 only. It got cut. I understand why. I understand that bridges fall down and roads need to be rebuilt and people are losing jobs. On the other hand, we're creating jobs and we need your help and involvement and we need your understanding.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me comment on the cash.
Mr. Schott.
The cash is available. We will probably be bringing in $10 to $15 million into our company over the next year from federal relationships. Department of Homeland Security, DOD, we make vaccines, Madam Chairman. And we make vaccines that against bioterrorism agencies, one of our businesses. So cash is available, but then the question is, where do you do this work? Well, having the University of Minnesota is absolutely correct. But also things like tax credits give you an argument back, if you will, to the shareholders who are only interested in money to stay in Minnesota.
Okay. Representative Mahoney?
Madam Chair and members, and I hopefully do some concluding remarks and you'll...
You got more questions.
Oh, well, I will say that there's not a month that doesn't go by that I don't hear of a very promising small company, 5-10 employees with the horizon in front of them being wooed by North Carolina, Texas, California. Actually, California, it's the VC capitalists coming in and dragging them out, Ohio and around. And this, as Mr. Shaw has said, is a step in the direction of keeping those companies here. But I'll stay for the questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you made any progress with the governor, his staff, or Zeed when you, when you brought forth this idea? I mean, he's always promoting the growth of jobs and so forth, and I would think this is an idea that he would jump on.
Representative Mahoney, working with the governor on this?
In seriousness, no, I have not.
Well, Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, I met the two fellows that are...
Mr. Shaw or Mr. Hare, have you had any opportunity to work on any of these ideas with the governor or staff?
We've started some tentative discussions. I think that one of the important things that came out in the governor's seed proposal was the SBIR match, which is another one of those elements that builds the wall of positive development. Indiana, for example, when it started the SBIR match, doubled the number of Phase $2 coming back in the course of about 2 years. And you can then do the statistics on the job growth that occurred as a result of that. So parts of it are being heard. And as I said, we need to, it's our job to give you a comprehensive picture of how all these things fit together. It's very complicated, I understand.
Thank you for that. For the questions. Representative Mahoney, I'll just share my thoughts with you. I think Representative Bremer kind of kicked the big picture off of this committee and the whole corporate subsidy question. And I just, I want to use your bill as another opportunity to try to get the tax committee members to sort of strategically and surgically focus on if we're going to do corporate subsidies, let's do targeted, effective ones at work. That's the trick for this committee. The data nationally is fairly lame. You can assert that these credits work or that they don't, and you have a pile of data to back you up. It's not clear whether smaller firm, kind of startup invested R&D credits are better than for the big companies, and that's some of the debate that's going on here. But what we've got is kind of in this room, we've got the whole jobs thing going and then the whole constraints of the budget, and so I don't think anyone in this room believes that there will be infusions of revenue for the state of Minnesota to buy a single tax credit to do anything. We're not going to be raising taxes. It's a non-starter. But I think we still have abilities to do the kinds of bills that Representative Mahoney is introducing if we have the will in this room to do it, and that means you have to cut something else. if to cut something we're spending money on to fund something like this. And I've been encouraging all the authors, and there are many, bipartisanly, who are carrying R&D credits, who are good defenders of them, whether they're for big companies or small companies, to try to think through what is the bucket we're funding now and what can be repealed so that some of these more targeted strategic investments can be funded. And I don't know if that sort of group of legislators can ever come to kind of an unholy alliance to get something like that out of this committee. We'll see. But, I should tell you that I am not a tax credit fan, and this room knows that. But your proposals before us, as many of the credit bills, are better than some of the other things we're hearing that create jobs in Minnesota. So I was glad to hear Mr. Harris say that Ohio gives money, and I have told the authors of these bills that's what they should propose, not tax credits. Tax credits are a non-transparent, in my estimation, illegitimate use of the tax system to create a behavior. If they want money to give a company something to do a great thing, they should just give them the money. And that means you convince a fiscal chair to provide a grant, which I guess Ohio is doing. So kudos to Ohio. That is the way to do it. If people believe that government should fund these things, then it should be a straight-up appropriation. It shouldn't be hidden in the tax code. But we certainly have a lot of folks who disagree with me on that bipartisanly. And I should just tell you that, we've got a continuum going on where we've got, in my estimation, kind of the worst way to create jobs being proposed, where there's sort of direct corporate subsidies to companies, whether they're old ones like Northwest Airlines, or they're new ones like the Mall of America, or they're, we've heard the Vesta Wind thing, we've got the U.S. Steel is looking at money for the IRRRB, and we've got kind of that bucket of give a company a bunch of money to do something, and that'll give you jobs. And then we move to the continuum to sort of jobsy, which is, in my estimation, failing pretty abysmally, and the price per job created is extremely high. Often to kind of the R&D world and these kind of nanotech, bio, drug, robotics, kind of high income, they're, in my estimation, if you're going to use money, use it there. Not as a Mall of America for minimum wage jobs that are retail. Throw it into what you're saying. But all of these things have issues because in the end, government's responsibility really is to kind of stay out of the market and not pick winners and losers. So to the extent that this committee feels, and I think this committee does feel, that one of the roles of government, even though people don't really want to say it, in addition to transportation, health care, and education, is they do think a role for government is corporate subsidies, because people don't seem to have the wherewithal to vote to stop them all. So, I'm trying to encourage everyone to be strategic about it. If we're going to continue to use literally hundreds of millions of dollars, which we're using, of taxpayers' money in corporate subsidies, let's target it, real strategically at these high-paying, kind of big payoff situations. And so I hope that Representative Mahoney and all the authors will take this very seriously, because, we are in a budget crunch and we have to cut some things. And one way to do that is to take an opportunity, use it as an opportunity and say, because we have to cut some stuff, let's throw out the stuff that's not working, let's stop passing the fake stuff we're calling jobs that isn't really jobs, and let's get some real targeted stuff done. So I think this is the year for people to take all these challenges and pursue it, because once we get back into a cycle of surplus, people won't find the political will to cut the things that are not very effective. So, Representative Mahoney.
Well, Madam Chair, on page 2, line 7, where the maximum credit under this division, I've got an amendment that might, about two, just put one more zero on that $2 million, and or maybe make it two, and I'll find that $300 million in corporate cuts.
Well, I thank you for that. I should throw in one other thing, by the way. There is one other legislator who has a non-refundable or has a refundable credit. That's Representative Bunn. And we understand that the liability issue, that it's nice if you can do those. They also, double or triple the price tag of the bill, because you're giving the credit to those who don't even have a liability to write off. But I think from a pure policy perspective, that's the way to do it if you're really trying to get it done. But that's the struggles we've got. I would encourage you to work with people like Representative Paulson, Representative Dabney, people who are very engaged in the whole R&D credit bucket, to find out if there can be some sort of compromise.
And for the Ohio part, my understanding in the Ohio part was it wasn't just a fiscal chair. The state had a significant vote on part of this, and that's where the real came from. The people actually, it was a What's your bill that you always carry? Referendum in this?
In
this? Yeah. In Ohio, when they had an unemployment rate of about 8, 9, 12% somewhere in there, and they were pretty desperate. And I hope the state of Minnesota does not have to get to a desperate spot before it's willing to make these kind of investments.
And I agree. It's just the proposals that you're presenting here for us today are competing with a lot of other proposals that certainly don't create jobs, that pay $70,000 a year. And that's kind of the bigger question that the room has to grapple with. So we appreciate you being here. Representative Mahoney.
Just one question.
Representative Fulbert.
If understanding the tax credit for a startup company, but once that company becomes very successful, do these credits continue to flow?
The current R&D credits absolutely do, yes. Yeah, so that's, again, a motivation to look hard at what we're doing and cut something and try to do something more strategic. So thank you for that, Representative Mahoney, and to your testifiers. It's a good discussion. We're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the honor of the tax show. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And so Representative Dabney is going to talk to us about Green Z now. So now this is another approach with Representative Demmer. This is again along the continuum. You might want to track this one. I have not yet read this yet, but my understanding is sort of like Job Z. So we're going to do this one now. Is that right, Representative Dabney?
Yes and no, Madam Chair. If I could move House File 4054 to be
Representative Dabney, House File 4064. Do you have an amendment too? Or
I do have an amendment. If I could move the H 4064A1 amendment. Sure. Mr. Michaels was good enough to catch what I would describe as some drafting oversight.
Okay,
that's
so
what I call them.
Dabney moved the A1 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Dabney.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I want to start by sucking up to the chair. In all seriousness, I'm congratulating you on putting Representative Mahoney's bill up on the same day with this one, because I think there are bridges, as he would say, a touchy word this year in the legislature, about between the two, about looking to strategically target incentives for Minnesota businesses and position Minnesota's economy looking forward. One of his testifiers described Minnesota, I don't remember his exact words, I want to be careful here, but kind of as having been asleep. I think that may actually have been his words on moving us forward and positioning us. And I think Representative Mahoney's work challenges that. I think this is an attempt to challenge that. My father-in-law was a journalist, so who, what, why, where, when, and how makes sense as a way to think about this bill. This is an attempt to target who? Any Minnesota business that is aligned with the major environmental and policies that this legislature passed last year, whose primary business activity is production of products, processes, methods, technologies, or services to increase the use of energy from renewable energy sources, to increase energy efficiency, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, or to mitigate those emissions, to protect our waters, and to expand the use of biofuels. To look at the developing area of the blue green economy. Tax credits, much like those as we see in Job Z, that's the what. The where, however, is anywhere in the state. We don't discriminate by region. But instead, and this is an area that we haven't explored as a committee, is help Minnesota develop job clusters where, by incenting green businesses, we can bring together businesses that at times can compete and at times can collaborate. And by building and strengthening those clusters and building on our strengths, we can yield much more than just the business activity generated initially by the job. When? Soon. And how? Through deed certification of these green manufacturers. The difference between some of the work that we've seen brought before this committee or the existing Job Z program is the why. It's how we target strategically the emerging green economy. And to talk to that, I have a testifier today, Mr. Lynn Hinkle with United Auto Workers, who have spent a lot of time thinking about how do we get manufacturing jobs back in the state and using the new emerging green economy as a framework for that. and I'd like to hand it then over to Mr. Hinkle.
Welcome, Mr. Hinkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm delighted to be here today to speak on behalf of House File 1064. I'm Lynn Hinkle. I worked 30 years at the Ford facility in St. Paul. 20 of those years, I was a union rep. In the last 2 years, prior to the announcement that Ford intended to close our facility, I had been given the assignment by my bargaining committee to keep the plant open. Nearly succeeding isn't quite good enough, but in the process we learned some significant lessons about where the economy was going. And while we weren't successful at convincing Ford Motor Company to rebrand itself using our facility as an example of a facility that could produce a green product that's aligned with a green energy source, our hydro, we learned some significant lessons about what's happening with a new energy economy, a new green economy, and we've persisted. I guess the good news is that we learned a lot in that period prior to April 13th, 2006, when Ford announced that it was going to close, and that group of folks that I said had given me the assignment to keep the plants open sat me down again and said, it's still your assignment, only you've got to convert our facility. And I think it's legislation like this that gives us the clearest opportunity to actually perform that kind of green conversion activity and provide good family-sustaining jobs in manufacturing the goods that are going to be required to meet the demand that this state has put in place on the demand side. The demand for potentially 3,000 wind turbines in southwest Minnesota based on the renewable energy standard. A 1.5 reduction in energy efficiency is going to create an enormous demand for high-performance buildings. Who's going to build the HVAC systems? Who's going to build the materials to retrofit those buildings? Who's going to manufacture those components? Biofuels, the same is evident there. You go through the entire set of legislative initiatives that are in place already in this state, and you look at the other couple of pieces that are coming forward in this session. One, to put together a transformation task force to help us do a better job, as the chair has indicated, to be surgical, to be strategic in the way we invest as a state, and then to provide the resources that this bill speaks to that can actually incentivize not just the demand side, but the supply side, which is so critical in this formulation. When you look at this state, and I know you're probably all aware of this, but I'm just going to restate some pretty stunning figures. According to Deed, between the years 2000 and 2006, now we're talking about two decades, we're not talking about three decades, we're talking about a six-year span of time, 50,000 manufacturing jobs were lost in the state of Minnesota. That's staggering. We're not talking about in the service sector, we're not talking about clerical jobs, we're not talking about retail commercial jobs, we're talking about 50,000 family-sustaining manufacturing jobs lost in this state. Now, how are we going to get those back? Well, we've taken some of those initial steps, as I indicated, by creating the demand, the suite of incredible legislative initiatives to create the demand, and now legislation like this will help us to incentivize the supply side so that we can move into that. Now, I'm going to look at just a couple of sectors, and then I'll conclude. I'm going to go back, actually, to my local newsletter. A couple years ago, there was a one-page article, and one of the bullets made a great point. The new market for wind turbine manufacturing alone, we're not talking about the whole set of even renewable energy equipment, but just wind turbine manufacturing alone represents a new core manufacturing base in Minnesota, especially if regional and national demand is considered. This represents development of a major manufacturing center that generates not just thousands of new family-supporting jobs in final assembly of wind turbines, but the production of parts, steel, and raw materials needed to supply these new factories. The green manufacturing would be an economic boon for all of Minnesota. This statement came out prior to some research, which I don't know if Representative Dabney is supplied to the committee, but perhaps at some point we could supply the committee with the report put out by the Renewable Energy Policy Project. And in this report, it goes through a number of states, and I'm going to look specifically at the state of Minnesota, where it indicates that in the renewable energy sector alone, the potential for manufacturing jobs over the next 10 years would be 18,405 family-sustaining jobs. What's really interesting about this report is that they didn't take pre-revenue, not to speak against that. They didn't take startups. What they've done is that they've identified those firms that are already in existence, that with a little bit of facility improvement, with a little bit of retooling, with a little bit of incentives, could move quickly into providing elements of the supply chain or the cluster of manufacturing jobs that could actually supply in a relatively short period of time approximately 20,000 jobs. Is that the only story here? I don't think so. If you look at the legislation that mandates a 1.5%, seems like a small amount, but it's huge in terms of mandating energy efficiency for buildings and the retrofits that are going to occur as a result of that. I just did some quick figuring because I thought it'd be easy for you all to see this. If sometime today you go out and you look up and down University Avenue, there are approximately 200 buildings on the St. Paul side of the University Avenue corridor that are 50,000 square feet or more. Now, it's estimated by the Apollo Alliance and work that they've done in Los Angeles that 100 large buildings, and that's in that range that I just cited, will produce 1,000 jobs that are manufacturing. Actually, they say it's quite a bit more than that, but if you just isolate the manufacturing, the operation and maintenance jobs, it shrinks down, if you will, to 1,000 jobs. Well, it doesn't take much of a mathematician to think about all of the corridors, all of the buildings. It's not just University Avenue and the 200 buildings there that would create, if we did the retrofit based on the legislation in place, a couple of thousand jobs. It doesn't take a mathematician to see how quickly we can fill or restore the 50,000 manufacturing jobs that we lost between 2000 and 2006 in the energy renewable sector, doing manufacturing of wind turbines, biofuel generation, or the HVAC systems that are going to be required for energy efficiency retrofits. We did some initial work. I collaborated with Representative Dabney and others to promote the idea of green manufacturing in the two cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I think one of the things that came out of that is precisely what this committee has in front of us today, and that is to create that suite of legislative initiatives, one piece of which is already in place. A couple of others are needed for the state to actually assume the position that it could. We've got a very small window, and I think it's interesting that people are talking about Ohio, talking about Pennsylvania. Ohio has approximately the 40,000 job potential based on this study, and they're moving quickly. The same suite of policies are being discussed in Ohio as we discuss them here. And what's critical, I think, for Minnesota is to understand that if we move quickly, we can position ourselves to become a cluster, a center for significant portions of this emerging new energy economy. I'll just conclude by saying it's an exciting time. We need to move quickly and forthrightly, and I think House File 1064 positions as well as a state to assume a position, not just to restore jobs that we've lost, but to move into perhaps a dominating position in the green manufacturing sector that is emerging in this country. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Henkel. Are there questions for Mr. Henkel or for Representative Dabney? Representative Dabney, I have one question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've sat here and watched the whole Job Z thing unfold and all the problems with Job Z. You know, I haven't read all of your bill. I'm assuming you're having a more accountable, tightened up sort of language in here than some of the problems we've seen with the Office of the Legislative Audit Report with Job Z. Did you attempt to model the Job Z language, particularly as it relates to when you're meeting the job count and the different agreements, or did you try to make your bill tighter and more accountable than the Job Z program?
Well, Madam Chair, fair question. This draft is based on existing statute on Job Z. I would certainly welcome ongoing discussion about tightening it up because I think that's appropriate. The obvious piece that we avoid with this proposal as opposed to Job Z is there's not an incentive for businesses to move back and forth across the state, pitting one community against another at this point.
Okay, so the statewide impact, yes.
Correct.
Thank you for that. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would the Kandy Ojai Partners project qualify for this, the new electrical generation project that's supposedly going to be sited in Hennepin County?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, I'm not sure. The science, I think, is still out on that as to the overall impact on carbon footprint, alternative energy. It's an interesting project because in some ways it's divided the environmental community as to whether it's a plus or a minus.
Representative, I think that's page 15 of the bill. I was looking at that too, sort of how do you define what a green business is.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see how that might be, a little bit of it might be a little hard to figure out. For example, on number 5, expanding the use of biofuels, wouldn't that alone be
mm-hmm.
fairly controversial in the green community? And not sitting on those committees, I don't understand all the nuance of the science, but it would be interesting to see if we did this, kind of who would qualify and who wouldn't, and I think that's what page 15 of the bill gets at.
Madam Chair.
Well, that's the reason I asked the question, is because that's proliferating all over the state. I mean, there's a new company, Renewal Fuel, that's coming into the state that's getting ready to locate possibly in many locations, and so numerous locations, so that's the reason I asked the question.
Yeah.
I asked specifically about that one because I know it's rather thorny in other committees.
Oh, okay. Thank you for that, Representative Dill. Representative Simpson?
And just to that point, Madam Chair, how do you define green manufacturing in the tax code?
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representative Simpson, I'd refer you to lines 15.17 and on. Primary business activity is production of products, processes, methods, technologies, or services intended to, and then aligns with the big environmental initiatives that we passed last year that Mr. Henkel has referred to. To remind committee members and Representative Simpson, you were one of the late stayers last night, Representative Kalin's discussion where Iowa has grabbed a lot of the wind turbine manufacturing industry by telling people you can build them here and you can install them in Minnesota. I would argue that Minnesota's better off if they build them here and install them here.
Representative Simpson?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Henkel, for your testimony, and thank you, Representative Dabney. We're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus text.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we have one bill left, and that's Representative Paulson, who's been very patient. So Representative Paulson moves House File 2779 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And Representative Paulson, do you have an amendment? No.
No.
No, you're good to go. Okay, thank you, Representative Paulson, and welcome your testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and please can explain the bill and certainly take any questions. But essentially, this is a bill that would provide what are called lifelong learning accounts, which are tax incentives for individuals and for businesses to save for individual accounts that would be portable and individually kept for opportunities for people to encourage their further training and work development as we make sure we focus on having an educated workforce. We've had a lot of discussion here about tax incentives for businesses, but this is focused more on the education side of the workforce. And I think this is a way of addressing the challenge of updating our education and our workforce systems to meet the needs of whether it's local or our national economy. And so it's very similar to a 401k plan. It would be portable. It would be able to follow you. And we have some individuals with us who would like to testify on its behalf from Minnesota companies as well as from others that have been experiencing some success around the country. So thank you.
Great. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randall Johnson. I'm State Policy Director for the Council for Adult and Experiential Learning. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, great.
The Council for Adult and Experiential Learning is a national nonprofit that's headquartered in Chicago, Illinois, and we're a leader in the field of continuing education and workforce development. First developed by Kale in 2000, Lifelong Learning Accounts, or LILAs, are a new way for employers and employees to co-finance education and training. The idea is that LILAs help workers and companies to effectively leverage educational resources to increase employer productivity, improve retention, and meet the changing needs of a new global economy. Much like 401k retirement accounts, employees contribute regularly to LILAs, and employers match individual contributions on a one-to-one basis up to an established annual cap. Third parties often match employee and employer contributions. From 2001 to 2007, Kale undertook a multi-sector LILA demonstration in Chicago, Northeast Indiana, and San Francisco, which drew in funding from 25 local and national public, private, nonprofit organizations. This pilot served about 350 people in four different industries: healthcare, hospitality, manufacturing, and the public sector. From our experience working with these sites, we've drawn a number of conclusions. LILAs were of interest both to individual workers and employers. Individuals and employers were pleased with the experience. LILAs were an effective asset building strategy. Participants used LILAs for education and training. LILAs served as a catalyst to pursue education and training. And LILAs improved employee retention. In light of these findings, the proposed Minnesota LILA initiative is poised for success. By creating a statewide initiative through the passage of HF 2779, Minnesota will be positioning itself at the vanguard of the national LILA movement that is taking root at the federal, state, and local levels. On January 4, 2007, Senators Maria Cantwell and Olympia Snow introduced the Lifelong Learning Accounts Act of 2007. If passed, this bill would provide $500 tax credits for up to 200,000 workers, as well as their employees, in up to 10 different states. These 10 participating states would be selected competitively by the Secretary of the Treasury. Continuing legislation has also been introduced in the current session of the House by Representative Tom Allen. Several states are also beginning initiatives. For example, the states of Maine, Illinois, Missouri, and Kansas have adopted LILA initiatives. Workforce development leaders in several other states, which include Iowa, New York, and Minnesota, and Michigan, are exploring the possibility of creating municipal or statewide demonstration programs. The proposed Minnesota initiative would largely be in keeping with the design provided in previous LILA demonstration programs. Where the LILA model would be enhanced is through the use of tax credits for employees, tax credits for employers, and through a special tax on non-qualified withdrawals. These innovations would provide LILAs with preferential tax treatment for the first time and create a penalty for non-qualified withdrawals. So in closing, we would like to congratulate the state of Minnesota for addressing the tough challenge of updating its state-level education and workforce systems to meet the changing needs of the local, state, regional, and national economies. It takes visionary leadership from government, business, labor, and education to accomplish these goals. Kale is pleased to support current efforts to create lifelong learning accounts and longer-term efforts to create new competitive advantages in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And welcome.
Thank you. I'm Valerie Pace with IBM in Rochester, Minnesota.
IBM in July of this year will roll out what is known as a matching account for learning. And a flyer has been shared with you, or will be shortly, that briefly describes this program. IBM elected to implement this program to reinforce with our employees the importance of investing in new skills and new knowledge to remain competitive. IBM makes significant investment in employee education already, and we have a tuition reimbursement program for courses that are relevant to the current job assignment or prepare you for future job assignments. But there's still a need for many employees to have an education account that would allow them to prepare for another career when they leave IBM. And the intent of this program is to incent employees to make investment in their own education. So starting this year, employees will be eligible to put aside $1,000 in an interest-bearing account, and IBM will match it up to 50%, $500, and that is portable when they leave IBM and can accumulate over time. Me, myself, and I intend to use my account to do a Spanish immersion class when I retire from IBM. So I think there are many creative ways that employees will seek to use this leverage funding that the company is providing and be able to take educational offerings from many of our higher ed partners in the state and elsewhere to advance their skills and knowledge. So we support House File 2779 and believe that this added incentive for employees to make this investment in their own continuing education makes good sense for Minnesota's economy, for the workforce and employers specifically, and it also invests in our own higher education institutions as well.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Pace. Are there questions for Ms. Pace or Mr. Johnson or Representative Paulson? Further testifiers?
More.
Sure, please.
Okay.
Please join us. Welcome.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm Kate Rubin, Plymouth, President of the Minnesota High Tech Association. And that's a representative of 350 companies, including IBM, as well as the very small companies that care about global competitiveness. Education is an absolute anchor, and we've been working with K-12, with STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, as well as higher ed for the last 28 years. Technology is always changing. You've already had a conversation about technology and the importance this morning with tax credits. But worker skills have to change, too. For instance, the Department of Labor estimates that a person entering the workforce today will have between 10 and 14 jobs by the time they're 38. 10 and 14, lifelong employment is a thing of the past, but 10 to 14 jobs in that first 15 years. More than that, 25%, one out of four people who are working in a company today have been there for less than 1 year. So the portability and the ongoing training is really, really important. When it comes to technology in particular, I've been working with a group of civic leaders on an awareness campaign to produce more college graduates. And the reason is all the studies that we look at tell us that we'll have 70% of the fastest growing jobs and 40% of all jobs will require some post-secondary education. It was exactly opposite. In 1950, 80% of the jobs were skilled, classified as unskilled. Today, 60% are classified as skilled. Just 60 years ago, 80% unskilled. Today, 60% skilled. And of those skilled, 85% require education beyond high school. 60% of those future jobs require training that only 20% of today's workers possess. So this lifelong learning is big stuff, and it's important. Technology jobs are growing fast. Earlier, Representative Mahoney was talking about how they were good-paying jobs. They are so good-paying that they're 69% higher paying than the average Minnesota wage, almost $71,000. And in the next 10 years, and it's probably down to about 8.5 years now since the study came out from within our own state from Deed, we'll need 20 to 33% more of those people through retirements and through the growth of those industries. So there's a local firm here that looked at the top 10 hot jobs from last year, and 8 of those top 10 were technology related. Many were entirely new categories, some from jobs that don't even exist today, Number eight was search engine optimization web consultants. Number one is .NET developers. Lots and lots going on. All of that tells you why we believe and our member companies believe that lifelong learning is so absolutely critical. Thanks to Representative Paulson for introducing that, and thanks for considering this.
Thank you, Ms. Rubin. Okay, so Representative Paulson, we have questions. You were done with testifiers?
Right.
Okay, so Representative Fulbert.
Madam Chair, Representative Paulson, is there some restrictions on how this can be used? Mr. Rod?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I mean, essentially it's been set up that the restrictions would have to be only educationally focused, and in working with Mr. Michael for drafting, it'd be very similar to a 529 plan in terms of the custodial capacity as well as what the uses of the funds would be used for. But it would be up to the individual for retraining, and that's certainly open to interpretation if he has suggestions.
Madam Chair, this case, I think, is that I testified that she's going to use her things that for Spanish immersion after you retire. And I would assume that to retire, I would like to be in Spanish immersion too, to be able to travel. But I don't know if that is means that I'm going to get a better job. I mean, I'm not using that to advance my career at all. So without some restrictions putting on place, I think, you know, I could have a nice little thing and retire and learn all kinds of languages and travel like mad and not contribute to the benefit of myself or the economy at all.
Well, that's impossible because Fulbert, it's not intended for someone to take a cooking class or something, you know, that they can take a new endeavor after they maybe retire. But maybe it's in common sense.
Mr. Johnson.
Yes. The public administration literature, there's actually been a number of different studies over the last 20 years that talk about how each additional unit of education up to a given amount provides additional productivity for the worker and additional benefits to individual employers. And that's been going out. I have some data here with respect to participants as well as the employers. And when we talk about the benefits of lifelong learning accounts, here we are. I want to refer to the section that says LILO's improved retention. It's the third category on page 2. According to an internal review of individual learning plans, which guides the selection of courses, this is done in consultation with the individual advisor. There's a logical nexus between the courses that are taken as well as their particular work description. However, they aren't bound to that. And it says that 70% of all participants across all sites use their LILOs for goals related to their current job, a promotion with the same employer, or related work with the same employer in the same industry. I hope that answers your question.
Madam Chair, my contention is that if there aren't any restrictions placed on this, you could use it for anything you wanted to, as indicated, and I would think there may be some age limits or productivity limits. Other people who go into training many times in advance and say how many years yet do you have to work, and there's nothing wrong with working until you're 90, but that's fine. But there should be at least some restrictions. Madam Chair, the other question is for Representative Paulson, if I may, because I need to have another obligation. Can you say why this is drafted to be under Dolly instead of some other Department of Finance?
Representative Paulson.
Well, and actually, Representative Fulbert and Chair, that's actually discussion we had, and so no, the intention would be that it would be received. I mean, that should be where the focus of the energy would be. I mean, it's been provided different states, but it's been tried up in Missouri to Hawaii to other states, and so it's really just a drafting issue to make sure that it's under the appropriate department.
Representative Fulbert.
Madam Chair, the reason that was brought up was one of my good friends that was here had to go to a meeting. He was concerned that the administration would come from the workers' compensation fund.
Thank you for that. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question either for Representative Paulson or Mr. Johnson. I'm trying to understand how this is similar or different from IDAs, from individual development accounts or family development accounts, which we already have in state law and are provided by a number of nonprofits across the state. It seems similar but different, and I'm trying to understand it. Why this and not that?
One of the primary differences is that it's focused upon education and training. That's one of the key restrictions. In addition, what we do is we try to actually mimic federal restrictions with respect to how these accounts are used. There's Title IV restrictions on similar accounts that are used at the federal level. And by Title IV, we mean institutions that are accredited under according to governmental mandates. And what this says is that it has to be recognized as an industry certification or degree granting program. And with that in mind, we try to create a new pot of money that would actually meet the needs of individual workers, people who are currently working that want to go back to school, and it complements tuition assistance from employers as well as federal student aid grants and loans.
Mr. Johnson, since IDAs can be used for education, I'm still not understanding how the difference, and it may be the federal technicalities that I'm not familiar with, but again, can you take another swing at the paper?
Yes, yeah. IDAs, they can be used in a more flexible manner. Mm-hmm. What our pool of money is specifically designed to do is to provide a way for current working adults to go back to school and use this to meet shortfalls in the current funding structure. Funding traditionally for working adults comes from two sources: federal student aid or grants, or through employer-sponsored programs. But those two pots of money don't cover all the needs of individuals going back to school. For example, it doesn't cover all fees, it doesn't cover books in most cases. And what this does is we try to specifically earmark this funding to meet those shortfalls, as opposed to being used in a more flexible manner.
Excellent, Danny.
Thank you.
Is there further testimony for or against this bill from anyone in the public? Yes, welcome. Sure, come on up.
For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Bonnie Alsey, and I'm with the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Welcome.
And I head up the Workforce Development Division. What I would like to say about this bill is that I operate all kinds of federal and state programs that are what I call reactive. People have already lost their jobs. People have already have to get their skills up to date. And in this state, in this country, we have very few programs to assist workers who are already working. And if you look at companies, when they invest in training, most of their training is going to management when they talk about how much money is being spent. And if you look at Tom Gillespie's data, 60% of the workforce that's going to be here for the next 20 years are already here. So improving K-12 today isn't going to help us for a couple of decades. Obviously, there's some people coming out. The real problem is people keeping their skills up to date and getting educated while they're still working. And I commend Paulson for introducing this bill. It is something that I've been looking at across the country as I see what other states are doing. But I think it's absolutely vital that business and workers together see that they jointly are responsible for improving the workforce. And the worker themselves and the employer, if the worker isn't got up-to-date skills, that employer is not going to be competitive. And everything is changing so fast, and I think what's nice and unique about this, what is different than the other kind of a family account you were talking about, is it's business and worker investing together.
Thank you for that, Ms. Was it Elson? Elsie.
E-L-S-E-Y. Okay.
Thank you very much. Are there further testimony? Any other questions? Well, Representative Paulson, I appreciate you bringing this forward. It's not something I'm familiar with, so it's interesting to learn about. And if I understand it, some companies are doing this now with or without a tax credit to do it. I guess the IBM proposal is without a tax credit, and you're trying to, on that big continuum of jobs, helping us focus on investments in the employee, and I think that's really laudable. It's not something I'm familiar with, so I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Certainly, Madam Chair, we would want to encourage the others to follow the lead that IBM has done as part of the goal. Well, I see there's no revenue impact, so it's easy for you to...
Yeah, I saw that. But, you know, honestly, I mean, I can see why a company like IBM, which is, you know, an excellent company, these are the reasons that employees want to work for these kinds of companies, that they have these kind of benefits. The nexus here with the tax committee is, of course, getting the state involved in it, but I think, again, it's helpful for all committee members to think of this continuum of what's a corporate subsidy. You know, this is probably up in the higher end of getting those kind of high-quality, high-income workers assisted as opposed to just a direct subsidy to a corporation. Representative Earhart.
I don't know why there wouldn't be a tax impact when you use 50% refundable tax credit up to a maximum of $1,000 per participant here.
Representative Earhart, I think there is. I think it's just unknown right now because there's a new program and it's not happened in any state yet. Is that right, Representative Paulson? It's happened in regions, but not in states, Representative Paulson?
We actually are in the process. Illinois last summer passed a bill and they appropriated $400,000 to do a pilot program that's targeted toward healthcare. And so we're in the process of actually identifying employers, and we can keep this committee as well as any interested parties looped into the information as we get it.
Okay. Thank you for that, Mr. Johnson. Further questions? If not, thank you, Representative Paulson. We're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill, and we have minutes. No, we do not. We are adjourned. Thank you.